Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cato Institute, and welcome to those watching at home and on television. I'm Peter Gettler. It's my honor and privilege to be the president and CEO of the Cato Institute. And I'm really pleased today to have Brian Kaplan, Megan McArdle with us for a book forum on the first graphic novel. Even though it's graphic nonfiction, I'm told, Brian, it's still supposed to be called a graphic novel. But the first graphic novel that Cato has ever published, and the second graphic novel written by Brian. And this one is called Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation. I grew up in a lower middle class town, working class town, and we were all pretty happy. We thought we were fortunate. And in fact, when I hear politicians always talking about how tough things are for the middle class, I kind of remember my childhood and remember that the American middle class, in the history of the planet and even in the context of the planet today, is one of the most fortunate demographics. But yet, I've become more sympathetic to some of the challenges faced by the middle class. In particular, if you think of the things that many people would consider elements of a good life, it would be to be healthy, to see your kids educated, and to be able to live in a home of your own. And I think it's ironic that in all three of these areas, we seem to be making the same policy mistakes. We restrict supply, and then we subsidize demand. And predictably, that causes prices to go up, and the policy response to rising prices is to subsidize demand more. And I think we're in a situation now where you can see all three of these, you know, important components to our lives, healthcare, higher education, and housing, are being priced out of the reach of many middle-class people. At least in the area of housing, there seems to be a growing consensus across the political spectrum that recognizes the impact that zoning and land use regulations are having in restricting supply and therefore exacerbating the challenges with the high and increasing cost of housing. And I'm really delighted that the first graphic novel or piece of graphic nonfiction we're publishing has been so masterfully designed and written by Brian in order to address this issue, the impact that government regulation has on restricting the supply of housing and therefore increasing the cost faced by, you know, American homeowners and would-be homeowners. When I get together with young people, particularly some of the young people on staff here, it really drives home. I'm old and I've lived in the same house for a long time, so I haven't been in the market for a home in a long time. But if you're a young person, even if you're doing well, it really is challenging to think about buying your own home. So I'm really delighted at this book, especially because Brian, in his first piece of graphic nonfiction, Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration, and now in this piece, I think it's really a remarkable vehicle for delivering these ideas. This is a serious book. You know, a serious person, even someone knowledgeable about these issues, I think would get a lot out of this. And yet, I think it would be accessible to even a precocious middle schooler. So I think that may be one of the things I'll save for the Q&A, how Brian feels both open borders and this volume are effective in getting these ideas out to the broadest possible audience. But you didn't come here to hear me talk, so I'm going to turn things over to Brian. But first, I'd like to remind you who he is. Brian is an economics professor at George Mason University. He's the New York Times best-selling author of the aforementioned Open Borders, The Myth and Science and Ethics of Immigration. He's also authored The Myth of the Rational Voter, Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, and The Case Against Education. This is the bio that Brian wrote for himself. He says he's mindful of the stereotype of the boring professor, so he strives to make abstract ideas thrilling. And he's an openly nerdy man who loves graphic novels and role-playing games. I also think it would be too strong to say that you're a provocateur, Brian, but I did hear you once say that what you like to do is put an idea that seems crazy out there and get people thinking that, hey, perhaps this isn't so crazy after all. And we're delighted to have as a discussant Megan McArdle. Megan, I think most of you or all of you know, is one of the original superstar bloggers. And also, I think it was David Weigel who said you made the transition from blogging to become an MSM journalist.
She's now took the Boeing, as we used to say.
She's now a columnist for the Washington Post, where I'm sure many of you read her. She also previously worked for Bloomberg, The Economist, The Atlantic, and Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and has been published all over the place, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, Time, Reason, among other places. She's also the author of the book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. And knowing that Megan and Brian tend to be philosophically aligned, I'm going to be very curious where the points of disagreement will be on the book. Although David Bowes once mentioned to me that he, David Bowes, would score about 60 on Brian Kaplan's libertarian purity test. So maybe there actually will be some points of disagreement. But without any more delay, Brian, take it away.
All right, thank you very much. It is wonderful to be back here at the Cato Institute. I was an intern here back in 1991. In the other building. I really appreciate how Peter's been supportive of this project. The dream is to have an entire library of libertarian nonfiction graphic novels on a wide range of important issues. So we'll see whether this one works out. All right. So why a graphic novel on housing? I get lunch with my friends almost every day, which is the best thing about my job. And there are two recurring questions that we ask our lunch guests. First of all, what are the biggest issues in your field? Secondly, why aren't you working on any of them? This seems to be a bit of a puzzle because people will generally say that they don't work on the things that actually are important. All right, now I will confess, I too occasionally work on a guilty pleasure issue that I recognize is not very important, it just happens to be fun. But I do strive to focus on what I see as the biggest issues. When I write a book, it's not just to entertain me, it's to take ideas that I think are very important on issues that are under-examined and to bring them to a much wider audience. All right, now how can you describe an issue as big? Big by what standard? Well, I'd say, look, in economic policy, the absolute metric, which is, or the obvious metric is this. How much would moving from the status quo to the free market actually change the economy? So you look at the world and you say, here's where we are. If we move from there to a free market, how much would change? The reason why I decided to write a book on housing regulation is because there have been decades of research that at least convinced me that a radical free market approach would transform the economy and for the better. It's not that hard to transform economies for the worse, but transforming for the better, that's the real challenge. Right now, the problem, when you actually go and read the articles that I'm relying on, you can go into the section of references, you can read them all. See, the problem is this. While the implications of housing research are thrilling, you can sit there and imagine this vastly better world, but the research itself is, by normal standards, boring. Right. As a professor, my standards of boring are different from most people's, and so I may go and read a table of numbers and say, wow, this is quite amazing numbers. But normally, when I step back and imagine handing the things that I'm reading to someone who is curious about the world but is not an academic, I realize they are going to be falling asleep, which then makes me think, what is the best way to bring the science to life to a broad audience without sacrificing intellectual integrity? The last part's hard. If you just turn on the TV, you can see all sorts of ways where people are bringing ideas to life, but with great sacrifice of intellectual integrity. So, in the words of Rod Serling, submitted for your approval, my Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation, illustrated by Audi Brandse, who is in Romania right now. But that's him there, if you can take a look. Yes, that's one of my favorite characters. That is the super cute baby lion that will grow up to be something extremely dangerous. And then down there, that's me giving a high five to Audie. All right, so what is wrong with the housing market? Over the last 50 years, U.S. housing prices have increased a lot more than inflation. and especially what we call the most desirable areas of the country. The trendy areas, the places where people say, oh, I really want to move to that place. I'm an economist, and even if you aren't, there's a really obvious story about what's going on in the housing market, supply and demand. Yes, of course, it's supply and demand. Like, demand is high, supply is low. Of course, prices are astronomical. Now, as usual, supply and demand is wrong. It is correct to say that supply and demand gives us insight on what's going on with housing prices, but it's still, in this particular case, deeply misleading. Because normally when we say supply and demand, it very much sounds like we're talking about natural scarcity. Why are courtside seats at basketball games so expensive? Well, there's naturally a great scarcity of courtside seats at basketball games. Everyone can't be sitting in the courtside by definition. What the research that I build this book on says is that it is not the case that natural scarcity is a big problem. Instead, housing prices have increased largely because regulation is artificially reducing supply and by a lot. Right, so what's wrong with the housing market? This is what's wrong with the housing market. One of the main issues in the book is what is the best symbol for government? Right now, outside of the US, Uncle Sam isn't a symbol for government at all. It's a symbol of the US. But since I was thinking of largely the US audience, I figured Uncle Sam is about the best we have. It is true, and I'm totally on board with most regulation of housing is actually state and local, but there wasn't any good symbol for it. So I said, well, Uncle Sam is a symbol of government in America, and I think this is the best that we can do for communicating this idea in one image. All right, so let me give you a quick tour of top housing regulations. Almost every country that I've looked at has a lot of regulation. Even places like India, where you might say, why would you go and stop construction in India when so many people are sleeping in the streets? And the answer is, well, we got our reasons. We're going to go and strangle housing even here. So what are some of the top housing regulations, the ones that wind up making a big difference? So one is height restrictions. We have the technology to build very tall buildings in desirable locations. We've had this technology for over 100 years. If you go and look at the skyline of New York City, you'll see a bunch of buildings that are very tall and are ancient. No one alive, or almost no one alive, remembers them being built any longer. But getting permission to build new ones is super hard. The ordeal to go through, the number of layers of bureaucracy, the number of rules you have to follow is so much that very few of them get built compared to the number that would be profitable if it was just a matter of, I own the land, I want to build this, get out of my way. Something that is particularly important in the United States is multifamily restrictions. A large majority of residential land is set aside for single-family homes exclusively. You can't do anything else. Minimum lot size, even when you are building a single-family home, very common to say you have to waste most of your land. And I do mean waste because normally builders would realize that while people like having extra land, they don't like it enough to actually pay anything close to the market price, unless, obviously, the government says that you are not allowed to go and build on anything less than an acre, in which case they are stuck. Minimum parking requirements also wind up mattering a lot. Seems like a picky point, but when you look at the numbers, it's very common to say that builders have to build 2 or 3 parking spaces per resident, which means that you have to go and, again, waste an enormous amount of land just to go and build anything. All right, much more, but that's a start. How much does regulation actually raise prices? We've got data going back now about 100 years where you can just look at how housing prices used to work around most of the first world, and we can see is that historically, even large rises in demand didn't produce long-term rises in housing prices. Back when population was growing much more rapidly than it is now, we didn't see long-run rises in prices. Instead, when there was a shock to demand, prices would go up, and then, as a result of this, prices would be above cost, and then markets would do the normal thing that you do when prices are above cost, which is produce more to make piles of money. This is how things worked. Once prices got above cost, this would lead to a lot more construction. The construction would continue until prices fell back to what we call the break-even level, the long-run competitive level. Rough estimate of how high prices have gotten now is that prices are now at about double the break-even level averaging over the entire country. So for the entire country, we're at about double the cost of production, the physical cost, the actual physical cost of doing it. How do we know? All right, the standard method here, which goes back to economists Glazer and Jerko, is to take a look at very similar homes that have different amounts of land and then use the extra price of the house with extra land to measure what is the value of land that does not have the actual permission to build anything on it. Go for it. What is that price? Right? And what they find is that the extra value you'll pay to have 100 square feet of vacant, unusable land for anything other than walking around or playing volleyball is real low. Then after you got this pure value of land, next step is to go to a big manual of construction costs used by people who are actually in the industry and figure out what is the physical construction cost to actually make the home. Right? Then finally, you sum the cost of the unimproved land with the cost of construction compared to price, and that gap is the measure of the effective regulation, which is often somewhat confusingly called the zoning tax. Sometimes someone who actually knows about zoning says, well, it isn't really a tax. Yes, the researchers know this. They just want to have a name for what regulation is adding to the price. So earlier work on this found enormous zoning taxes in your most desirable area. So Bay Area, New York, LA, right, places like downtown Chicago, right, but didn't find much elsewhere. And then the idea is, right, severe problem in some places, but for most of the country, it's not very important. But then later on, researchers got better data on vacant lots and bringing the vacant lots at different distances from downtown areas. And what they found is that actually in almost all major population centers in the U.S., there are large zoning costs. Government regulation is adding a lot almost everywhere that a lot of people live. Right, so if people are there, they probably are actually paying a lot extra because of government. Now, why write a whole book on housing in particular? Doesn't government raise prices of other stuff? Sure. But here's the key thing. People spend way more on housing than they're doing on gasoline or chewing gum. So when you double this cost, it is a huge deal. You're doubling the cost of something that is a large share of the budget, which means it has a large effect on living standards. So a rough estimate is that housing costs are about 20% of your budget. So if you could have that, cut the cost of living by 10%, and then raise standard of living across the whole U.S. by an average of 11%, which is a ton. All right, now this brings me to my very favorite chapter of the book, the panacea policy. Who here has heard the word panacea before? Yes, all right, good. I talked to a few people, said they never heard of it, and like, no, this is a common word. All right, anyway, all of the evidence that I talked about points to a really straightforward, brain-dead way to dramatically increase living standards, which is housing deregulation. We got regulation, regulation's the problem, get rid of the regulation, things can go back to normal as they used to be. All right, but what really motivated me to write this book is when I realized that there's a lot of other problems that seem unrelated but are in fact closely connected to housing regulation. Many of these problems, people think of them as they're so intractable, what could possibly handle any one of them? And I was looking at the evidence saying, not only do I know how to handle one of them, I know one policy that simultaneously make a big dent in a long list of problems. All right, so deregulation promises to dramatically mitigate many other social ills, including inequality, social mobility, poor prospect for working class males, homelessness, environmental issues, low fertility, and also crime. All right, so let's see. All right, so let me just go through some of the main arguments here. Inequality. This one's real easy. The share of people's budget they spend on housing falls with income. Rich people spend a smaller share of their income on shelter than poor people do. That means if you reduce the price across the board, you are doing more to help poor people than rich people. That, by definition, reduces inequality. And since, this is a large share of the budget, this makes a noticeable difference. Similarly, it's also true that homeowners are higher income than renters on average. For landlords, as we're going to see, rather for homeowners, housing deregulation is a mixed bag. There are a bunch of good things for homeowners, which definitely should be pointed out, but at least for homeowners, you can say, yeah, but also my primary asset is going to fall in value. For tenants, it is a clear-cut gain because they don't own the property that is losing value, and so they just pay a lower price without a loss in asset value. Social mobility. There used to be a really clear-cut way in the United States, very simple, where a person that was motivated could raise their standard of living. Just meant, say, like, if, unless you live in the richest, highest wages parts of the country, leave where you are, go to a high wage area, and pocket that extra raise. Right. In the past, it was true that housing prices were a little bit higher in high wage areas, but it was a small difference, so that almost anyone who wanted to go and rise could just pack their bags, get in their car, drive to a high wage area, pay a little bit more in housing costs, have a lot more in income, and enjoy the difference. What Congress Ganong and Shoag showed is that it is no longer true that this works in the modern United States. Because now when you move to the highest wage areas of the country, housing costs are so much higher that the housing cost increase eats up more than 100% of the wage gain on average. And therefore what's going on is that people are tending to leave high wage areas of the country, which is almost unprecedented. It's like, I'm gonna go to an area where wages are lower. It's like, why would you ever do that? Because the housing cost is so much lower that I actually get a gain. When you go and read the work, they have even more interesting details, like high-skilled workers can still get a gain by going to high-wage areas because for them, the housing cost is a smaller share of the budget and the wage gain's larger. But for a journal, for a janitor to go and move to New York City today from Mississippi is a way to get poorer, not richer. Another big gain. Poor prospects for working class males. You probably heard of the book Deaths of Despair by Nobel Prize winner Angus Deaton and my dissertation advisor, Ann Case. One of the main things they show is that non-college males have done very poorly by a lot of measures in recent years. And their favorite story is that non-college males have a lack of work that at least feels meaningful for them, right? And what kind of work feels meaningful? Well, the classic one is manufacturing jobs, and this is classic manly employment. This is one where, despite all sorts of efforts to go and revive manufacturing, it is pretty much hopeless, because for the simple reason that we are close to satiated on manufactured goods. Who here wants to go and own 5 televisions? On the other hand, there is another classic kind of manly employment, which is construction, which is still high wage, and where still most people would like to get a lot more if the price were right. Most people today would like to have a much bigger place if the price were reasonable, whereas they don't want to get a whole bunch of televisions, right? And again, what does this specifically do for working class males? Well, a large majority of people working in construction are, first of all, non-college workers, second of all, male. So not only are you making it affordable for them to have a home of their own, but also you are creating a lot of extra jobs. In particular, this is something where if we were to go and say double employment in construction, it makes a huge and transformative difference because it's a large industry now. If you were to double it from roughly 10 million to 20 million, this would be a transformation of what it is like to be a non-college male in America. Homelessness, this is one that I was skeptical of when I first started going and working on this, but because I was thinking of homelessness as living on the street, but actual statistics are more like not having a permanent address. And for this, it makes a lot of sense that if you go and make housing more affordable, people are gonna stop sleeping on their friend's or brother's couch or stop couch surfing. And again, this is what the evidence says, is that a very strong predictor of actual measured homelessness is just the cost of a cheap place. All right. Our environmental issues, this is one where, again, Ed Glazer, together with Matt Kahn, has done some very cool work showing that actually new construction has a lower carbon footprint than old, because even though it's bigger, it's much better insulated. Furthermore, the areas of the country that are nicest in terms of weather conditions, Southern California most notably, these are places that have very low heating and cooling costs, and yet also, perversely, they have regulated prices in that area so high that people flee, and when they flee California, where do they go? They go to places where they will have a larger environmental footprint. Low fertility, this is one, it's a bit more controversial, but the papers that are on this are on my side, and again, common sense just says one of the main reasons why you keep living in your parents' basement is because housing is expensive. As long as you're living in your parents' basement, you're highly unlikely to get married and even less likely to start having kids. So I think when you put that together, it really is hard to believe anything else other than this is going to make a dent in it. And last, there's crime. Why don't we go and talk about that in the Q&A, but very cool experiment there. Right, so why not? Why haven't we deregulated? Right, I've got a real simple story for why almost all of our policies exist. The policies that we have exist because most people think that life will be much worse without the policy. People want housing regulation because when you tell them about not having it, they get scared and say, oh my God, what could go wrong? There's a standard list of complaints that almost everybody has when you bring this up. What's bad about building stuff? It's gonna give us more traffic. It's gonna give us more parking problems, bad for the environment. We gotta protect the character of the neighborhood. And then, of course, there's a classic preventing conflicting uses. I don't want a pig farm next door. So let's make sure you can't do that. Now, in the book, I go over some key rebuttals about why these arguments just aren't that good, or why, at least if they are true, they are still misleading. First big principle, gratis is not great. Giving people stuff for free is, though super popular, a terrible idea, especially if it is a good subject to congestion. When you make driving free during rush hour, this doesn't mean that everybody gets to enjoy a pleasant drive. It means that everyone is stuck in traffic. When you say that we are going to make all parking cheap, even on a very popular day to park, it doesn't mean everyone gets nice cheap parking. It means that you have to drive around for half an hour to find parking. Economists have been talking about this for a long time, saying, why don't we go and charge a price greater than zero for driving during peak times and for parking during peak times and solve the problem that way? Right. Now, the standard thing is it's not fair. What about poor people? So instead, let's go and double the price of housing. That's really fair for poor people. It's like, it makes a lot more sense to go and raise the price of these narrow, specific goods that are vaguely connected to housing than to raise the price of housing, which is a much larger hit, right? Obviously, right? Now, I know that a lot of people will still resist it, and if my dad were watching, he'd be saying, Brian, people need to drive. You can't charge them for this. It's like, it's a lot better to do this than to have a house cost $1 million. Second point, just like I was saying, Glazer and Kahn, letting people live in temperate cities is green. If you were a real environmentalist and care about the planet, you would want to go and make it super easy to build a ton of housing right in California. What's going on right now is parochial environmentalism, like, I don't want the planet harmed right next to me. It's like, it's a planet, so that doesn't make any sense. All right, and then finally, just ripping off Bernard Siegan, who I think Cato published some of his stuff back in the 70s. He wrote the classic study of land use in Houston. And here's what he said. While people get really worried about urban pig farms ruining the neighborhood, that kind of thing, market forces lead to a natural separation of uses. Even when it is legal to go and build things next to other things where people wouldn't want them, it rarely happens. There's a reason why most manufacturing is right next to harbors and train stations. That's because you want to get low transportation costs. There's a reason why most commercial construction is on main roads, because you want to get drive-by traffic. There's a reason why when you have a nice neighborhood, you want to build another nice house to it, which is that you get a bigger premium from someone who wants a nice house than from someone who wants a lower quality house. Of course, this doesn't mean that you would have a guarantee, but a lot of what's gone wrong with regulation is this hunt for the guarantee. I want an absolute assurance that nothing bad will ever happen. Well, the only way we can do that is to prevent tons of really good stuff from happening. That's what happens when you say, I want an absolute guarantee, because to give someone an absolute guarantee is like, well, what if there was a 1% chance that something could go wrong? Then no, because that's messing up my absolute guarantee. All right, so really, why not? Why do we actually regulate housing? What is the real problem to overcome, and what is ultimately the goal of this entire book? Well, to start, I just want to go and argue with almost all fellow economists and say it's not primarily about protecting property values. It's not. It is convenient to go and point fingers at people who disagree with you and say, you're just a selfish jerk that wants to protect your property values. It's not completely wrong, and there are some people that want to protect their property values, but it's really overrated. How do we know? First of all, if this story were true, existing property owners would not be saying, absolutely not, no way, never, no matter what. They'd be saying, let's make a deal. How much are you willing to pay for it? How much are you willing to pay to rip down 100 historic homes in San Francisco and build 5 skyscrapers instead? That's what an actual selfish person says when you make them an offer. Not, no way, I don't care how much money you offer. A selfish person says, what kind of money are we talking? All right, so if true, existing owners would happily allow development. Emily, how could you do it? Well, one thing would be to say, how about we give a property discount, property tax discount to all the existing owners, and we pay charge extra property taxes to the new developers. How about that? So let's make a deal, all right? Now, another reason, now just to go back, I was mentioning there are selfish reasons for owners to want to go and protect their property values, but on the other hand, there are some selfish interests going the other way. Like, what if an owner wants to upgrade? If you own an historic home in San Francisco, wouldn't you like to be able to sell out to a developer who will tear it down and put a modern building? Why? To make piles of money. To make piles of money. Right? Or suppose you want to subdivide your land. Suppose you wanted to go and expand it. These are all areas where regulation is, in fact, in the real world, often bad for owners. We tend to forget about the ways that regulation is harming the existing occupant, but it often does. Furthermore, suppose you want your adult kids to live within 100 miles of you. That's important, right? You might say, well, I'm going to be really selfish here. I don't want any additional housing built. I want to keep prices high. Do you want your kid to be able to live near you? Well, yeah, I want him to be able to live near me. Well, how do you propose to make that happen if the price of a house is $1 million? I suppose I could go and get a giant home equity loan against the inflated value of my house, give it to my kid so he can make the down payment. Or we could have deregulation where housing prices are just lower and we don't have to worry about that. All right. Furthermore, as I discussed in the book, there's actually a lot of evidence that renters support regulation too, which fits with the idea that people just think it's bad for society rather than that they are out for themselves. Because, of course, a renter, in terms of basic economics, well, what do you care whether the price of housing comes down? It's actually good for you. So what are the good stories about why we have regulation? So the good stories are as follows. First of all, just status quo bias. Things are great the way they are. They shouldn't change ever. Right. In the book, I've got a picture of the old Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which is a gorgeous building. It was torn down in 1929 to allow the construction of the Empire State Building, which is even better. Why assume that when people tear down old buildings, they're going to build something worse? Why? Well, we've got a lot of psychological evidence. This is how people are. And the great news is if you just let people do what they want, change happens, and then people get used to the change. And then pretty soon they can't even believe that they ever thought otherwise or they've just forgotten. So a lot of the problem is just status quo bias, just getting people to think about how beautiful the world could be but isn't yet. And that's really the whole point of Chapter 5, Bastiat's Buildings, where everyone knows great French economist Frederick Bastiat. In the book, I resurrect him, and then we travel around the world and see the world as it might be but is not. Economic illiteracy, right? This is one of my favorite root causes for a lot of bad government policies. Right? Economists tend to think everybody knows that if we go and deregulate, prices will come down, but the problem is that hurts some people. Well, we've actually done some pretty good surveys, even experimental surveys, where we ask people, what do you think will happen if we allow people to build a lot more housing? And the rough breakdown of the public is a third of people think that would raise prices, a third thinks no difference, a third think it would bring them down. So roughly speaking, the public has a random view on this issue where almost all economists would agree, of course, allowing more construction brings prices down. So if people are in, two-thirds of the public is in total denial of the main benefit of housing deregulation, it's not surprising that hardly anyone supports it. So what I want to do in the book is change people's minds, overcome the economic illiteracy. Another problem, sheer innumeracy. All right, so this, everybody knows the approximately equals math sign. It's that squiggly one. It's not the straight bars. All right, so 1 trillion minus 1 billion approximately equals, not exactly, approximately equals 1 trillion. Yes, but try using this argument in a debate. I've been in a bunch of debates where I had $1 trillion argument that was completely solid, and the opponent said, yeah, but what about these $10 billion complaints? And what I want to say is, look, even if all your complaints were true, I still deserve to win because those are $10 billion complaints, and I got $1 trillion benefit, so the benefits vastly outweigh the costs, and you're just being petty about this. But they beat me in the debates because 10 particular vivid, whiny complaints are a lot more persuasive than one giant, overwhelming argument in favor. So I think this is a big part of the problem. I illustrated this in this debate between the bear and the mouse, where the mouse crushes the bear. But the Bears, much cheaper housing. That's the story. Right, and last one, kind of inspired by my dad, just paranoia. You mentioned building new things, and many people's minds do go to the worst possible case, which does happen once in a long while. But the reasonable thing that you do when you're evaluating something is, well, what normally happens? What typically happens? I still remember when a major new development happened when I was in high school and I was just learning economics, and my dad was very upset about it. He came down and complained about all the corrupt city councilmen that approved this horrible thing. And I sat there trying to argue with him, no, this is actually really good. And he's, you don't know anything. All right, so 30 years later, he doesn't even remember he was ever against it. But I remember. I remember him saying the sky would fall if it was built. Nothing has happened. He's not even aware that this development even exists anymore. But I think this is a major problem of his worst case thinking and the weaponization of this in politics. All right, to conclude, here's my 2-page audiobook. Let's see. The text is actually too small for me to read it, but yes, I do remember. Let's see, if I turn around, I can see it. Yes, as Bentham put it, and there I've got the auto icon of Jeremy Bentham. Remember how Bentham was literally mummified? All right, but as a mummy, he can speak in a graphic novel, and yes, what he said is, the request of industry to government is as modest as that of Diogenes to Alexander. Get out of my light. And that is my solution for America's housing problems and the world's. Thank you very much.
I guess that means I'm up. So as I read this book, I thought multiple times about Dorothy Parker's famous review of a book, said, this is not a book that should be read and tossed lightly aside. It should be hurled with great force. and I want to take this book, and I want to go to every state legislature and city council in the country and just start throwing it at the legislators. Hopefully it will hit them in the heads and knock some sense into them. I already knew before I started reading it that I was going to agree with the book. I did. So it was a little bit of a struggle to be a respondent rather than just to like bring my pom-poms and go, Brian, build, baby, build. So, yes, exactly. No, so I came up with the questions that I had as I went through it, with the first of which are empirical. Right, so some things, you know, for example, we are definitely seeing people move out of high productivity cities towards lower productivity places where it's easier to build. And I think that is obviously being driven by housing prices. I don't know that all of it's being driven by housing prices. I think there are other issues here in terms of quality of life, in terms of, if you think about an American city, the cities they're leaving, these big coastal cities, right, which is where most of the problem is, by no means all, to be clear, you know, as Brian talks about, Miami, Dallas, there are lots of places where, especially in the center city, there are still issues. But the big issues are along the coasts. Those are where, for a variety of reasons, it's become, there's just a stranglehold on the ability to build in the densest and most productive areas. But if I tell the story of those cities, right, there's a bunch of technological enhancements that make the city what it is, right? So those cities tend to be, they were all architected around railroads, basically, right? Now, they've been, many of them, rebuilt and changed with highways and so forth so that they are less oriented around that center transit hub. But if you look at all of these cities, you're ultimately going to find the same pattern, which is they were originally built around one or many rail stations. And the design of the city is around that. There's transit links, there's roads, and so forth. And then what happens in the 50s is that we enable people to live further than walking distance from a railroad station. And that is transformational. And we essentially open up a bunch of land to development that had not been feasible to develop as commuter housing before. You could work downtown while living in a single family detached home farther from the rail station than you could walk in, say, half an hour. And that's just a major technological improvement that allows people to live and work in different places, people who could not previously have afforded it to have a house, and they all move, right? So I think that some of what you're seeing of people moving away from those cities is just that places, there was another technological revolution, air conditioning, which has enabled places like Phoenix to just be a place that you would desire to live. And so again, by no means all of it is that. I think obviously Brian is correct about that, but I do have questions about if we could massively upzone New York and San Francisco, how many people would want to move there, or would we still see some out-migration for other reasons, for other policy reasons as well, right? It's not all housing, it's other things, taxes and so forth. Second, again, small empirical quibble because we are nowhere near the limit, whatever it is, but how high can we really build? You know, I love Brian talks about these giant skyscrapers on Central Park that take advantage of the view. Those actually turn out to not be very good buildings. And they relate to a well-known problem in building, which is that elevators are actually a huge constraint on how high you can build. So after about 30 floors residential, the sheer amount of elevator space that you need to get to people to their apartments starts eating into the apartment value, and you get less and less value out of each successive floor, which is why if you know some of the ultra tall buildings like the Empire State Building, not the Empire State Building, the old World Trade Center building, they actually had staged elevators where you would take one elevator to a mezzanine on like this, I think it was the 78th floor, and then you'd take another elevator. So these super tall buildings are only being built abroad because they're not actually very practical as office buildings. So there is some of that with residential as well. Those ultra-tall buildings on Central Park are now, one of them is now mired in lawsuits because the residents don't like it, and were only really feasible because there's one apartment per floor. If you had less than that, if you had more than that, if you tried to have a more normal building that tall, you wouldn't be able to get enough people up and down to make it a practical place to live. Again, however, this is a quibble. You know, if you look at some place like New York City, you could definitely make a lot of buildings taller than they are. Third question I have, I think, is a bigger question. And this goes back to that technological revolution of the 50s, also the technological revolution of rail, which allowed, you know, streetcars, which for the first time allowed people to be more than walking distance from work. There's another technological change, which is remote work. I think it's still an open question how much this is going to change American life, and I think it's going to take a couple decades to really work through it. But how, when Brian talks about the productivity gains that you can get by moving people into cities, right? And this has been a staple of this literature. How big is that product? Most of the data we have on that is still really pre-pandemic. So is that productivity gain as big as it used to be? And if not, what does that imply about the economic benefits of deregulating housing? Then the last question I would have, I think my biggest empirical question, it really is a question. I am not a demographer, I don't know the answer. But Lyman Stone and some other people have been making what to me is a credible argument that really dense living is actually bad for fertility. For a couple reasons. There may actually be some deep evolutionary machinery that we don't know about, that just when the population gets dense, you just have less urge to reproduce. We see some of this in nature, right? The reproduction rates slow down as the population gets
shades.
More and more.
You definitely need shades.
But there's also, look, I grew up in Manhattan, and my mom had two kids because I grew up in Manhattan. She wanted four. And we had like a pretty much ideal situation for growing up in an apartment, aside from having like eight full-time nannies or something, right? We lived in a building where there was a playroom, where there were four other little girls my age that I could run around the building with. We basically, in the 70s, it was like a little small town. My mother had no idea where I was on weekends from like 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. I came home for dinner. I might be at our apartment, but I might be at any one of other apartments, and she didn't know. She would just call around if she needed me. We were a couple blocks from Riverside Park, which had excellent playgrounds. But the fact is, if you're raising a kid in an apartment, and I can also say this as someone who has had a dog on the 15th floor, and now and then on the first floor, and then in a house, it's just like the need to get another creature up and down in the elevators, and oh my gosh, I forgot the diaper bag back up. It seems like a tiny transaction cost. It's a minute, right? Maybe another minute of waiting for the elevator. But psychologically, it's actually a huge transaction cost, and it makes it way more unpleasant. It also makes more unpleasant that like you can't go to greenery unless you physically escort your child and stay there and watch them. It just increases the intensity of parenting. It decreases it when they get into middle school. or at least it did in my era, when they would not, when your parents were not hovering over you all the time, and I was allowed to go around the city on the subway by myself. But that, I think, might be, like, I think housing costs on, obviously impact fertility, but I sort of ask whether push it, whether if we build all of these super dense buildings downtown, at least, whether we're actually saving fertility boost from that. I understand, look, there's filtering, you know, people move, people without kids move into the city, other people get their single family homes. But I do have questions. So then I have some policy questions. And one of them is, does this densification of all levels, right? That was mostly about tall buildings. But densification isn't just tall buildings, as Brian Abley points out, right? It's also townhomes. And it is putting single family homes on a quarter acre lot instead of a full acre lot. It's all of those things, right? But in a lot of cases, both with tall buildings and with other kinds of development, this densification is gonna require a bunch of complementary goods, right? It's gonna require better sewer systems. It's gonna require, at a minimum, better roads. If we're talking about more dense kinds of living, especially if we're talking about doing something that Brian recommends and which I endorse, which is getting rid of minimum parking requirements, it might require public transit. And I have a couple questions about that. One is that many of those things have the same veto points as housing, right? It is harder to build infrastructure than it used to be because we have given all this community control, created environmental review systems, upped the building codes, all of the things that are making it harder to build housing, we have also are also making it harder to build infrastructure, plus a bunch of interest group and special regulations that have made American infrastructure costs some of the highest in the world. And so how does that figure in, right? Can we densify if we don't fix that problem? Does it require other extremely unpopular policies like congestion pricing, one that Brian mentioned? It's really, like, I love congestion pricing with a passion seldom found. I love the market. But I love free pricing of water. Here's another, you know, question for building in the West, in California, in Arizona, in Colorado. I love pricing, fully pricing water. Why are we giving this away for free? Why are we giving parking spots away for free? I love all of these things. You know who hates them? Like every other voter. So every time you poll these things, they poll badly. And so a question I have is, if we need to do these things to make the densification work without so congesting traffic, so creating externalities like pollution from congested traffic, how, you know, like, what do we do about that problem? Does it require political goods that are actually popular, but which are, for a variety of reasons, hard to do? So the things I think about when I think about densifying, right? Schools. I don't want the quality of my kid's school to go down. Crime. It's not exactly true that urban areas have higher crime necessarily than rural areas, but the crime is more, stranger crime is a lot more likely in a city than in a rural area. Domestic violence is not more likely, but stranger crime is, and that's a real cost that people really care about, and that will make your densification project harder because for it to be healthy, it needs to be economically integrated. So how do you get affluent people to move in if you don't have better crime control? How do we think about providing those goods? And then, you know, are some restrictions enhancing? So examples, one is people don't like to live next to tanneries, right? Should we have some, no, you cannot build your super polluting factory next to my 100-year-old daycare? But also do we think about things like, one that I think about a lot is that when you have a major thoroughfare and you build a building that doesn't have storefronts in it, it creates dead space on the street that makes it really unpleasant and actually makes the neighborhood worse and less vibrant and actually less function as a neighborhood. Again, this is more of a tall building problem than a lower density problem, but it is a problem that I think about because it's something that I've seen happen in my neighborhood where, like, you've just built a lot of dead space on the street because the developers, again, for somewhat, you know, because developers basically didn't want to deal with their bankers on retail leases, which are more complicated in some ways than retail. And then I want to talk about the political constraints a little bit, because I disagree with Brian somewhat about the rationality of the political constraints. I do think that there's a selfish element to it that's quite strong. And I think that some of the data on renters tends to be confounded by the fact that, like, cities that have a lot of renters are also tend to be cities that have a lot of rent control. And so, look, if you survey renters in San Francisco or New York, it is true that they don't have the same kind of property right as a homeowner in those cities, and therefore it seems a little weird that they are in favor of restrictions. But a significant number of them, and especially the older voters who are easiest to poll, do have rent control conditions. And they basically, and this is actually one reason that I really fight with the people who are like, homeownership is bad, we need mass renting and then rent control to solve the political problem of homeownership. That does not solve the problem. The renters will act just like homeowners because you've given them a property right in their apartment and they will then fight to protect it. And I think that the rationality is broad. It's not just about property values, which is where this tends to focus, right? People tend to be, although I think that is a huge problem. Rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly, policy has created a situation where you have a lot of people who have got a lot of home equity, and that's their biggest asset. And they are going to, quite rationally, fight to protect that home equity. And I see this in my neighborhood, which is extremely progressive, and then there's me, the libertarian, and my husband, the libertarian. And we get into hilarious discussions where, like, the libertarian is explaining why we should allow social services to come in and build something that's going to serve more poor people to all of my super progressive neighbors. Because I'm a crazy ideologue. But most people are not crazy ideologues. And they think this is going to be bad for my property values, which is objectively true. It is going to be bad for our property values. And that is something that you see over and over again. Light, right? Yes, it is silly to say, well, we can't ever build taller because it's going to wreck someone's light. But actually, having lived on a subterranean first floor apartment where sunlight was something I had read about once, it's actually, when I finally got an apartment that had light, I could not believe how big a difference it made in my quality of life. So if I had that apartment already, would I want someone to take my light away? Absolutely not. I would be extremely upset. Luckily, I'm a crazy ideologue. Unfortunately, most people are not. Neighbors matter, right? I mean, it is not irrational to try to keep people who have problems out of your neighborhood. That's completely rational. And I think, Brian, you live in a single family home in what I assume is a nice, fairly crime-free neighborhood, and you have chosen to do that, right? And you would not be happy if someone opened up, say, a halfway house across the street from you. You might be like, yay, I am theoretically happy for America. I'm not personally happy for me. And again, we are crazy ideologues, most people are not. All of these facts, combined with the fact that, as Brian says, people are economically illiterate, but I also think there's a kind of a death by a thousand cuts problem, which is that, we talk about zoning restrictions or building restrictions. It's not, or the building code, or it's not one thing. It's so many teeny, teeny, tiny things, all of which individually make very little difference and sound great. Who could be against requiring that, toilets have lots of clearance because someone once got stuck in a toilet? This is an actual situation I dealt with my home, where we were not allowed to make the walls, we wanted our bathroom to be smaller, and we were not allowed to because someone might get stuck in the toilet. And my husband and I are not going to get stuck in our toilet. We had plenty of space. But someone could, so no one was allowed to have this bathroom. But if you say this, right, some disability advocate is going to say, well, if you do that, it makes it harder for me to buy that house. And that means that I have a restricted availability because of something that's beyond my control, and that's not fair. And that is every single restriction. They almost all, have good explanations that sound good, and you have to fight them on a thousand fronts, and how possible is that? I would also point out that, like, poor people and renters don't just have necessarily this kind of quasi-property right in a rent-controlled apartment. They also have, they don't have a lot of financial capital, but often they have quite a bit of social capital embedded in a low-density neighborhood that's hard to replicate in a high-density neighborhood, right? So if you live in a neighborhood of townhomes, old row houses, and you know all the people in that street, and you know the person that you can send your kid to if you need to go out or whatever, if that's torn down, all of that capital just vanishes because as people move. But also, it's actually that kind of capital is much harder to build in a denser neighborhood because they just tend to be more anonymous. It's just kind of inherent in the form. And that suits the upper middle class and the middle class pretty well. Can be a harder form factor for people who have less financial capital and more need to rely on social capital. And then you add in the fact that most people can't, won't, never will think through the second and third order effects. I think it's a big challenge. I would also say that the let's make a deal thing, which I love and I want to do, it's really hard to make a credible commitment, right? Because you're new residents or voters. So you start off by saying, okay, you're worried about X, Y, and Z. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to make their top property taxes high and you get to keep yours. We're going to deny them parking and you get to keep yours. Problem is now those people live there and they vote there and they resent it. And eventually, if there's enough of them, they're going to say, nah, that deal is undone. And so I think that's again, these are political challenges, not intellectual challenges. And then the last thing I would say is on that whole subject of a lot of like the let's make a deal, what keyhole policies that Brian calls them. How are they different from a slippery slope? Aren't they just, you talk about the dangers of the slippery slope, where we allowed zoning in Euclid v. Ohio, is that right? Or we allow zoning and that just, we're now on the slope pedaling downwards towards our current wretched situation. But making those compromises to try to get something done, is that not just opening us up to the slippery slope? But look, ultimately, these are small questions relative to the big question, which is how do we solve a bunch of social problems while making us all richer? And I think Brian obviously has the right answer to the big question, which is big build, baby, build. And I really, really hope that this book will get into the hands of as many people as possible and make sure that as many people as possible know how right that answer is.
I think, Brian, we're going to want lots of time for questions from the audience, but I see you writing down against Megan's criticisms and questions, so why don't you some time responding.
Yeah, thank you very much, Megan, and if someone actually disliked the book, how many criticisms would they have? All right, but just going through some of the highlights. You're absolutely right that housing is not the only reason that people move, although it's important to remember that when you add in other factors, it could be amplifying the effect rather than mitigating it. So for example, what would be happening to relocation of the population if California said same housing prices everywhere else? California actually has a bunch of non-housing advantages in terms of fantastic weather. And so when you see, there might be some other reasons, but it actually is compounding because that's an especially nice area and people are still moving away from it. And the same goes for a lot of the country. There are some places where you say, people are moving more to the south because of air conditioning. All right, fine, but there's other areas that are nicer than ever, and especially when you remember that our country has gotten richer overall, and when people get richer, they put more value on amenities like nice weather. Right? So you would think that actually the south, you can move to the south is fine because of air conditioning. It's like, I want to move to a place where I don't need air conditioning, and that would be more like Southern California. Let's see, on the question of how high, in writing this book, I did go and read a bunch of papers estimating the cost of construction as a function of the number of stories, and realizing, there's a lot of disagreement here about exactly what the key breakpoints are. But a very common view is that 40 stories is crucial, and from 7 stories to 40, it's fairly constant cost per floor. And then if you just go and take a look at an aerial view of either Central Park or San Francisco, you'll see there's almost no buildings anywhere close to 40 stories. Probably the only reason you're seeing any super tall construction is because if you can get permission to do one, then it's worth doing super tall. Yeah. But if you get permission to do 100, then it's like, we're not going to go and do it that high.
Did say it was a quibble.
Yes. So on telework, one thing that is great about free markets is that when there are large social changes, this opens up opportunities to take advantage of those large social changes. So one thing you can see with telework, it's like, I no longer need to live in a place where I like the work environment. So then where should I live? How about I should live in a place where I like the play environment? And that is a lot of the problem with regulation, is that rather than going and crushing this one thing, it's crushing another thing. Although it is worth pointing out that we do have some good evidence on how important it is, or what's the right way of putting it? There's some good evidence on how much immigration restrictions go and reduce productivity, even when it seems like telework should be a totally fine solution. So when I was writing Open Borders, there, like for comparable Indian programmers, they're making triple the wage in the US versus in India. You might say, well, like, what's the difference emailing your work assignments from India versus emailing them from the US? But it did seem like the market considered there to be some very important differences in being physically there. As to what they are, it might just be team building or something like that. It's a little hard to say, but what we do know is that that's an even stronger experiment. And it does seem like telework is not, even for programming, which would seem like the ideal case, is nowhere near enough. Now, on this density fertility thing, the correlation's undeniable. The question is the causation.
Yep.
All right, here's the thing. We need to go and find a place where you've got, where it's really dense but super cheap. That doesn't exist. That would be the real test. In terms of the common sense test, it's like, well, sure, I don't want to have a lot of kids if I'm living in a 200 square foot apartment. But what if you could live in New York City in a 5,000 square foot apartment? What about then? How do you feel about having kids then? That's something where we could look at the super rich right now, and they probably are actually having large families when they are able to afford that large of a place. At the very high.
I think if you looked at those people, you would actually more likely see that the people with large families have decamped for like palatial suburban.
Right. Right. But in any case, we really do want to do this experiment. The obvious story is precisely that it's prices rather than density per se. And if you were to cut prices, people would then have large amounts of living space in a dense area. Now, furthermore, notice that this complaint really only holds specifically for high rises anyway. And when you're talking about allowing people to go and build more homes on single family lots, that kind of thing, then I'd say that the effect on fertility is totally clear. Let's see, on the complementary goods, it is worth pointing out they do charge property taxes on this construction, and they use this property taxes to go and build this stuff. Since it's at the local level, it does usually roughly pay for itself, but there are some complications. Yeah, on congestion pricing, I totally know it's really unpopular, and that's why I'm trying with everything I've got, all the way down to getting a Romanian artist, to change people's minds and make them realize that they're being very silly about this. It is a bizarre fetish to say that parking should be free, driving should be free, when it is causing so much harm. You know, I think the real problem is economic illiteracy, just convincing people there is some connection between the price and the congestion. Hard as it may be to believe. I do have, my favorite argument actually is to take a 5-minute walk from my place and there is a bridge over Route 66 and to show people, count the cars in the 4 toll lanes. Count the cars in the 6 free lanes. Do you notice the difference? Are you convinced that the toll changed the congestion? Not convinced? All right, let's come back 20 more times until you're convinced, because it's so clear, how could you deny it? Let's see. On the question of the political motivations, my first book is The Myth of Rational Voter, and I have done a lot of public opinion research. I will say that I think that the idea that people are voting their objective self-interest is so popular and yet so fundamentally wrong. It's one where people are desperate to go and find some connection between objective self-interest and voting. On this, people said, well, look, it's just so obvious that your home price is important to you financially. Is it more obvious than that the income tax is important to you financially? And yet, as we know, people's income is a terrible predictor of which political party they support. Clearly, right? There are so many high-income Democrats, so many low-income Republicans. The causation is really clear of which party favors higher taxes, and yet people don't seem to pay that much attention to it. What's going on? I think that actually I'll say is that I think that most people are a lot more like me and Megan than she says. I think almost everyone is a crazy ideologue. It's whether or not your ideology is especially insipid or not. So that's the real problem. Almost everyone is forming their political views not from any observation of the world, not from calculation of self-interest. Rather, it's a philosophy. The philosophies are usually just so half-baked, quarter-baked. It's like, your philosophy is that parking should be free? That's what philosophy says? And yet, that is the kind of philosophy that a lot of people have. It's not fair to charge a nickel for parking. It goes against the laws of nature. It's like, why that? Why is that the thing that ought to be free, rather than a million other stuff that you pay for? Barely any answer. The story that's with rent control, it makes it especially, or at least it reduces a lot of the reason for tenants to be supportive of building more housing. I think at least one of the papers that I have is a national sample. Most cities in America do not have rent control, but it's very normal for tenants to be in favor of regulation. For the same reason I say that almost everyone favors almost everything in politics, they think that it's good for the country. They haven't put a lot of time into this assessment. They are not reasonable about it. It's hard to bargain with them. But that is the reason, so that's really what I'm focusing on, is to get a change in people's philosophy. If you say, that's really hard, Brian, yeah, I know. I've been working on this stuff for 30 years. Really, this book is my latest effort to persuade someone that doesn't already agree with me. You were mentioning how even middle school kids might appreciate it. I've had kids that are in elementary school enjoy it, and this is actually when my daughter was reading my first graphic novel over my shoulder. So I've got something here. I've got something describing academic research that a five-year-old is voluntarily reading. So that is my best solution, is get them while they're young. So hopefully we can do it. Thanks to, by the power of Cato, we shall.
All right.
I might suggest that your children are perhaps not representative sample of.
But they're still five. She was still five.
We're going to go to questions, and we're going to take questions both from the audience here at the Institute and our online audience. The online audience can join the conversation and submit questions directly on the event webpage, Facebook, YouTube, and on X using the hashtag CatoBooks. I'm actually going to take the first question from the online audience, because it basically relates to what you just said, Brian. The question is, how successful do you think the first book and now this book will be at reaching a very broad audience compared to your other work?
Well, let's see. The Open Borders, my first graphic novel, was a New York Times bestseller, so that's better than any of my other books have been. Will I make the best bestseller list? That's out to you people in social media land to decide whether it makes the list. Buy many copies. See, in terms of its likelihood of actually changing policy, here I'm just going to be brutally realistic and say odds that one book has a big change, it's really rare, right? And generally the books that have had a really big effect have been bad books that have made the world worse. So, Communist Manifesto, Little Red Book, they were really popular, they changed the world, but they made it worse. So for a book to make things better, maybe Capitalism and Freedom, Milton Friedman, Free to Choose, maybe Hayek's Road to Serfdom, they may have pushed things a bit in a better direction. And even that is kind of speculative. We don't really get to see the world without those books being written. What I'll say is, I'm doing the best I can. My honest assessment is probably I get tens of thousands of readers. Unfortunately, I need tens of millions of readers. And that's life. I just do the best I can.
Let's take a question here. We have microphones. Please wait for the microphone so that the rest of the folks in the auditorium and the people online can hear you. And please give your name and your affiliation. And please, a question, not a speech or filibuster. Sir, back here.
My name is Tim Hewson. I'm very active with the YIMBYs of Northern Virginia.
Thank you, Tim.
I'm looking for arguments to convince the many, many people who believe that building more housing will increase prices, because I know so many smart people who actually don't think of supply and demand. So I haven't read your book yet, so perhaps you have ways to say that, to convince people.
Yeah, so the main argument that economists have made is called housing filtering, and it says even if I go and build some new luxury apartments that no one with an income below the 99th percentile is going to be occupying at first, Still, where do you get those tenants? You get them from people that are currently in some other nice units. And what happens there? Well, they move some people there, and they meet some people there in a giant chain reaction. Since most people are unlikely to be persuaded by the actual research, I think probably the best argument here is just to go and say, look, take a look at the vintage of the homes that low-income people are living in now. How often do low-income people live in stuff that was built in the last 3 years? Almost never. They're almost always living in older stuff. And it's like, what would have happened if 20 years ago we stopped them from going and building that thing, which was nicer and higher end when it was first built? The answer is that the place that is now being occupied by low-income people wouldn't have been built 20 years ago, and then where would they be? So I think that point of just reminding people, look at the housing that is currently housing the people you care about. When was it built, and what did it look like then? And the answer is, when it was built, it was nicer. It was, you know, you don't generally build something at first to go and sell it to low-income occupants, but filtering is not a theory. It's just something that you can go and check in the basic property tax records when you just see when was that thing built and realize that that's how people with low income get places, is they get places that were not originally built for them, and then they filter down to other people in this very natural process.
I think when I have this argument, there are two things. One is, I think you do have to acknowledge that there are isolated cases where it increases property prices in an immediate area, right?
Yeah, sure.
So like Union Market, I happen to live near, it was not developed at all when I moved in, and it has massively increased my property values. For those who don't know, it's a neighborhood in Washington, D.C. and near Northeast. And it really increased my property values because now there's all these nice amenities there that weren't there when I moved in. Now, citywide, the fact that there are now, I don't know, 1,000, maybe more units built in and around Union Market has lowered the citywide cost of housing relative to the counterfactual. But if you just tell people this never happens, I think they don't trust you. And so you say, like, look, this can happen locally, but our job is not just to preserve like these five houses here, the prices here. Our job is to make sure that everyone in the city has houses. And the thing, it's an analogy that Brian uses in his book, but I find the musical chairs analogy really helpful, because that's something that just cuts through. Like, I think we often, because we're so immersed in it, we find it hard to think how hard people find it to think abstractly about these questions, right? They tend to think extremely contextually and locally. And so they will say, like, you're gonna displace this tenant, you're gonna do this, and you have to say, look, it's unless you build enough housing, it's a game of musical chairs. You know, I did a talk on housing at Chautauqua a few years ago, and it was so hard to convince people that there is no way to make housing affordable other than building more housing. And finally I was like, look, there are, you know, some number of people you need to house. If you do not build enough housing for them, there is no other policy solution that solves that problem other than having enough housing for them to live in. And that was when they finally got it, was to stop thinking about prices, actually, and to just start thinking about, like, there needs to be a unit for every family to live in.
One other quick point, you could also start with the regulations where you really have to twist your mind to see any other effect than it being good for lower income buyers, like get rid of minimum lot requirements. How could it possibly be good for the poor to say every house has to have an acre? Like, I think that's just really hard to say, like, yeah, I just don't say, and that's a big regulation. So if you just get people on board with that one, you're already doing a lot better than one could reasonably hope.
The second row here.
Hello, my name is Austin. I'm a first-year economics student at George Washington University. I have two questions. My first question is about fertility. So Melissa Kearney at the Brookings Institute has said there's no relationship between the cost of living in an area and fertility. And it's also been shown that women report having less kids now than in the past. So with those findings in mind, do you think that housing deregulation would really noticeably significantly increase fertility? And my other question links together your two graphic novels. I agree that getting rid of immigration restrictions would be immensely positive, but it seems the one downside is that you increase immigration, you increase housing costs, And with the zoning we have in place, those housing costs aren't going back down. So given the immense benefits of both zoning liberalization and immigration liberalization, do you have a preference for which we should do first? Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. All right.
Thank you.
So first of all, on the fertility point, I'm pretty convinced. Here's the thing, all right? So the total number of papers on the connection between housing prices and housing regulation and fertility, I think I was able to find 4 papers ever written. So that's just truth in advertising. I'm not hiding papers that said something else. I'm just saying that's all the papers that I could find. All right. Now, I would say, just in terms of common sense, the point of one of the main reasons people keep living with their parents because housing prices are high, I think that's just really clear. And I think you'd have to be pretty crazy to say that's not an important reason why people keep living with their families well into adulthood. The idea that living with your parents doesn't depress marriage, hard to believe. The idea that living with your parents doesn't depress your fertility while you're still living with them, also hard to believe. So I say, in common sense, I think that it's really clear. I did a blog post called Basement Fertility, where I just had a map of Europe and whether you're living with your parents and what fertility is, and not a perfect correlation, but yeah, it's what you'd expect. Down in Southern Europe, when they keep living with their moms until they're 40, they have hardly any kids. And you move up north where they're moving out and having independent lives and they don't have fertility of 3 or even 2, but it's a lot higher than down in Spain or Greece or Italy, where you just basically have your mom do your laundry your whole life. So that, and you know, like, is it just culture? It's not just culture. It's like they are squeezed in there, they don't have privacy, it's just so expensive to go and get your own place there that it's at least a big part of what's going on. So yeah, I'd say that it seems really clear to me. But again, to be honest, not just based upon those 4 papers, but also common sense and basic economics. Let's see, on the question of should you prioritize housing over immigration the other one around, like, I am very much in the school of take whatever you can get as soon as you can get it. Right? It's so hard to get any deregulation. If you start going and saying, well, I'm not going to favor this until I get everything else that I want, wow, that's it. There's never going to be any deregulation of anything on this story. In the case of the effect of immigration on housing prices, I think it is clear that it does raise housing prices when you get a lot more people from an area there in a highly regulated area. But by the magic of federalism, a lot of what happens in the United States is that population growth happens in the low regulation areas. And so even if the immigrants themselves go to the high regulation areas, the ultimate result is that population doesn't grow in the areas the immigrants went to. It grows in the other places, and obviously a lot of immigrants just cut out the middle stage and they immediately go to the place where prices are low. So yeah, that's so much of what's going on in the US is, someone says, well, the whole country, like, prices seem high, but they're not equally high everywhere. I could always go to Texas and be able to afford a home while working at Dairy Queen. Not something you're gonna be able to do in New York or the Bay Area. So yeah, don't prioritize. Take whatever you can get, the second you can get it. Could that possibly cause some other problems? Yeah, but that's the least of your concerns. The real problem is getting nothing ever, which is what normally happens.
I think Brian thinks more like an economist and less like a politician. As a journalist, I might think a little more like a politician. So what I would say is this, is that building more housing undercuts one of the reasons to oppose immigration. Whereas having more immigrants come in and driving up the price of housing might actually make it harder to deregulate as people panic about the influx, and therefore I would say probably try to do housing first if you had to choose. But again, right, politics has a lot of determinants, not just one. Like in a, you know, philosophy seminar, probably housing first, but in a real world political world where there's a lot of moving parts, whichever one comes up first.
Yeah, and honestly, I think that people's understanding of their objective self-interest is so weak, and the effect of self-interest on political views is so weak. It's true that people definitely complain about immigration when immigrants raising housing prices, but I think it's better to think about this as, which complaint about immigrants am I going to make now? Yes. Rather, you know, there's people who have that complaint. It's not like, otherwise, I think they're great, but they just have this one problem. Instead, normally, again, partly based upon talking with my dad, there is a foreordained conclusion, and then there's whatever complaint seems like it's going to work right now the best is the one that I'm going to bring up. But you kind of are in a Sisyphean ordeal where however hard you try, you're not going to change people's minds on that, except with the power of graphic novels, of course. But
here's an online...
And great journalism.
Here's an online, an online question. We like empirical evidence. Are there good examples, or what's the best example of housing deregulation, and how has it worked out?
mean, honestly, I'd say the best examples are of just continuing low regulation, which I think is a fair measure. So best examples of continuing low regulation, Texas is one of the crown jewels of the U.S. When you actually go to Texas, they'll start arguing and saying, no, we have terrible regulation here, and like, you know, the price of a house in 30 minutes outside of Austin is up to $300,000. And you're like, and it's only got four bedrooms. And it's like, do you realize how good that sounds to most people around the country? I'm not saying it's perfect here, but it's really impressive how things are working here compared to how they are in the rest of the country. In terms of specific deregulation, where you start at high regulation and then you go down by a noticeable amount. In the last chapter, I talk about depressing facts. One depressing fact is that out of all the high regulation metropolitan areas in the U.S., none became noticeably more deregulated between 2006 and 2018. Zero. So there were places that got less regulated, but these are places with hardly any people. All right, so that's like, oh man, all right, this is a tough situation. It's true that in recent years there have been some deregulatory policies, especially going after single-family zoning in places like California, Oregon, Minnesota. There's a bit there. I wish them well. I hope that it works out. At least for California, I did read the fine print, and I was very depressed when I read the fine print, because part of the fine print says, yes, you can take your single-family home and turn it up into a quadruplex, up to four homes, but the owner is not allowed to sell to a developer. You must occupy your home while it gets turned into four homes. Which California said, this is to make sure that you get the payoff from the development. Only if you continue to stay there will you get the money. You've got to manage it yourself. This is like saying, if someone finds oil on your land, you should have to drill the oil yourself to make sure you get the money out of it. You can't sell to someone who knows what they're doing. All right, so obviously the real purpose of this is to gut the original deregulation, because you go and make it such a pain in the neck to go and actually build more homes, they're figuring not that many people will do it. So that's where we are. Like, it is a tough situation. And like, the main point that I make in the book is all we need to do is change people's minds about this being good for society, and then it will happen. All the other complaints are not a big deal. This one thing is hard. That, now, of course, that's like saying if you could just break through a 10-foot brick wall with your head, that would be fine. That would solve the problem. All right, true as far as it goes, but still, like, we got to start chipping away, like the Count of Monte Cristo. After 7 years or 70 years of chipping away, Cato's been chipping away for now
45 years.
All right, years. Like, persistence wins the day.
Yeah.
Like a bulldog, hang on and. No one else will have our attention span, and we will do it.
Yeah, for sure.
One day.
Never give up.
Well, just think how crazy it would have seemed in 1965 to say, like, we should deregulate trucking. We should deregulate banking. We did it. It took a long time. And I think the consensus on this has only really started to emerge in the last 20 years, in part because the problem has only become so bad in the last 20 years.
I actually wanted to ask you, when I got the book and looked at the blurbs on the back, I was thinking to myself, oh, you should have asked Paul Krugman for a blurb. And then I saw that he was in the book.
Yes.
Because I know he's written columns about this. Did you ask him for a blurb?
I believe we did. I'm not 100%. I believe we did. Obviously, Paul's a busy guy, and he's great on housing. So if you're watching this, Paul, thank you for being great on housing. And I hope you like my representation of you in the book. And if you want to give a blurb now, even better.
This is a question that's not really directly related to housing, but you mentioned it as being a component of this problem. So, Brian, you've written a lot about economic illiteracy, of course, starting with your JLE paper. How do you think we should best deal with that issue?
Right. Economic illiteracy, the scourge of humanity. Right. Of course, we could all become economics professors, but there is so much truth in the idea that economics professors are boring and waste a lot of time on irrelevant details and fail to get the big point across. Probably most of you here have seen young Ben Stein, or only middle-aged Ben Stein, doing the economics teacher in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Libertarians tend to think that if we could just get a better argument, then people would have to change their minds. When I meet people, he's like, no, we don't. Like, I think we already got some really good arguments. The problem is delivery. So rather than going and trying to reinvent the econ textbook, I recommend we dust off our copy of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Mm-hmm. This is a book about how you actually win people over. How do you do it? by being really friendly. Don't call them stupid. Yes. Don't call them evil. Instead, win them over on a human level. Step one is just seem like a decent person. And I say all this not because I'm so great at it. I say all this because I know that I need improvement, and I've improved from where I was in high school anyway, because I was terrible back then. All right, so just smiling, right? You get a lot out of that. Have a sense of humor. Right? And again, a lot of this is why I do the graphic novel, is because in the graphic novel, I can always be the best version of me. In real life, I'm just not. But the cartoon me is always the friendliest, happiest me with the correct emotional reaction to every situation, down to the percentage.
It is very friendly. Yes. It is
yes.
very friendly.
You know where I'll even say, tell the artist, make me 3% sadder here. And it really will do it. So that's what I'm going for. I've got the right emotional palette. But yeah, like you could go and try beating people over the head. I think it's just much more productive to have a sense of humor about yourself. Mm-hmm. I hope that comes through in the book. It's my sense of humor anyway. I have done stand-up comedy, and that is, again, I'm not going to say I'm great. I don't get paid to do it or anything, but to put yourself in the frame of mind where you could do it is, I think, a good thing for libertarians to do. I think what we really don't need is the classic, what you foolish moochers failed to see, right? Look, that'll work with like 5 people. But we've already got those 5 people, so now think about something, another way to say the same thing.
I think Matt Iglesias suggested that we need to have a reality show, which instead of flipping a house, it's like you just watch a developer attempt to get through environmental review. Mm-hmm. It gets sent back 90 times. And I think, yeah. We need more. It's sad to me that conservatives and libertarians are so bad at making movies. I don't know if anyone has seen, I'm sorry, this is mean, but like the Atlas Shrugged movie, it was not good. And it was like, this is a general problem with like Christian books. I'm a Christian, they're not good. Many of them, some of them, a few of them are good. Most of them are not good. They're sermons with a cast. And like one reason that this is hard, honestly, is that it is so easy for progressive Hollywood to make movies where developers are the villain. Why is there no conservative movie studio that's just gonna make a normal movie, no preaching, no whatever, just like casually, the villain is the environmental group that's stopping them from building a beautiful 200 unit house that could house all of these people who are living in substandard apartments right now. And that movie doesn't get made.
There are specific heights.
Fair, yes, actually, that is true. I will say,
and you cannot help but sympathize with the landlords,
right? But there's
performance for Michael Keaton playing the most evil tenant who ever lived.
There should be more things like that where conservatives and libertarians, rather than trying to make a sermon with a cast, just make a good story about places where these government constraints are wrecking people's lives, because they do wreck people's lives. The hard thing is that it's unseen. And I think that is one reason, right, you can see the house you're tearing down with a little lady in it. What you can't see is all of the people who are living, you know, 50 minutes from work in an 8th floor walk-up because they can't get a place closer to work because you didn't build a building. And that is, I think, actually, so I should say that even as I am slamming conservative and libertarian people who are trying to do this kind of thing, and I think one problem is that donors tend to want to fund something that's more explicit, that's more like, I'm going to tell you exactly what you should think. But another problem is that actually dramatizing the unseen is really difficult. And one reason I really like this is that Brian's done a good job of showing some of the unseen
and also
stuff.
I might point out, if there's anyone in Hollywood, just normal, regular Hollywood people watching this, if you read this book and want to dramatize it, great. I think it's actually a lot easier to win over people who are already making good movies.
Fair enough.
To the cause of housing than it is to go and turn someone who agrees with this into a great Hollywood producer, which sounds like a stretch, although, like, I'll always take what I can get.
We have time for one more quick question and brief answer. Right front row.
Quickly, Mark Lerner, it seems to me that building codes would have a much more impact on the house price of housing. And if do you know how much? And if that's true, how do we scale them back?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Simple answer, shortest answer, is that researchers have barely looked at building codes. So it's possible that's adding a lot more, but what we're doing right now, essentially, is just look, comparing the physical cost, which includes everything the building code makes you do, with the land cost where you don't have permission, and comparing that to price, and we've got a huge gap there. Building codes may very well be adding on an additional amount. There's one economist whose name escapes me who is insistent that there's also a bunch of very important regulations against prefabricated homes, which he says do not confuse with trailers, and that that's really important. He's the only person who thinks this, and I couldn't find anyone else who was even weighing in, so I didn't want to talk about it too much. But the guy may be right, actually. So it may be that I am understating the severity of the regulation, but the key thing is the regulations that I mentioned seem to be doubling the cost, and it may well be that building codes are actually amplifying even more with very little gain.
Yeah, I had the same thought. It was that Robert Heinlein, the science fiction writer, wrote in the 50s that if you thought about what it would cost to build a car the way we build houses, where they haul all of the materials to the site and then physically construct a car, the car would cost $100,000 and be terrible. And why were we still building housing that way? And there are some reasons. For example, you know, you want to contour a house to the landscape and to orient it towards the light and so forth and the weather in a way that you don't with cars. But that said, we should be just building a lot more prefab modular housing. We should be using industrial production techniques, and we're just not. And yeah,
there are some regulations that are relevant. What I wasn't convinced of is that they were so binding that they were crushing the industry in the way that these other regulations, I am convinced they are crushing the industry.
I think the one thing that is clear is that the financing of mobile homes, which has gone on to manufactured housing, really is a problem, is that the way the FHA loan, I think it's FHA, but the way that some of these government loan programs work make it very, very difficult to finance these things, and therefore, like, they appreciate more, they depreciate faster than normal housing, and they are harder for people to buy, and that's a big problem and shouldn't happen.
I want to thank everyone for coming.
Yeah.
I want to thank the online audience. And thank you for sending your questions. And Megan, thanks for doing a great job finding things to criticize.
I love the book, Brian. I don't know why you thought I was being critical.
And Brian, thanks for...
Aw, hug it out.
But Brian, thanks for creating a great book. We're really proud to have published it. And now please join us in the Winter Garden for a reception. I'm sorry our online audience can't, but go to your fridge, grab a beer, or the liquor cabinet, mix a drink, and think of us, we'll think of you. Thanks a lot.